Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Ron Brooks Show. Today, are the socialists back? They seem to be back. Back in the UK, back in the US, or maybe for the first time in the US, really. And we're going to talk about migration into Europe. We're going to kind of follow up on last week's discussion of foreign policy. I think it would be appropriate to talk about what is going on in Europe, why it's going on, and what we should be doing about it, if anything. Well, let's start on this question of socialism. You would think that socialism would be dead by now. Everywhere it's tried, it fails. We've got some pretty cool examples right now in the world. Cool, you know, not really cool, disastrous, horrible. In places like Venezuela. And yet, there was just an election for the head of the Labour Party in the UK. And over the last, 20 years or so, the Labour Party in the UK has shifted to the centre and maybe even a little bit to the right with Tony Blair. It's generally not trying to undo much of what Margaret Thatcher did in the 1980s. It has basically left much of the economic freedom that was achieved during the Thatcher era alone, with some modifications, leftist modifications here and there, and some compromises. But generally, the consensus has been among the political elite in the UK that Margaret Thatcher was a good thing. That Margaret Thatcher's, even though they wouldn't admit it, that Margaret Thatcher's policies with regard to labor policies, unions, with regard to freeing up the economy, deregulation, privatization, were generally good, and leave those things alone. And that's been pretty much a consensus left and right. I mean, again, left and right have not really continued moving in the right direction. But they have not undone much of what Margaret Thatcher did in the 1980s. And let me just say, before we go on to this issue of the new Labour leader, let's just say that I just want to say something about Margaret Thatcher. Thatcher was good. I mean, Thatcher was about as good as you can expect of a leader in the West in these times in terms of adopting a pro-market policies. Could she have been better? Absolutely. But when you think about the world we have, the philosophical state of the world, when you think about where our academics are, where the intellectuals are, the state of the world as it is, Margaret Thatcher was about as good as it gets. And people forget what the UK was like was Margaret Thatcher was elected. I mean, she was elected. She was elected at a time when the UK was a pretty dark place. Unemployment was high, inflation was high. London was dirty, pressing, and there was no economic activity really. Nothing was growing. The only thing keeping I'd say London alive in that period was the money flowing in from the Arab states, from the Gulf states, petrodollars, and you were starting to see the real influence of that all over London. Customer service in London didn't exist if you walked into a store. Production in the UK was declining. I mean, economically, the UK was a disaster when Margaret Thatcher took office. London was an unbelievably depressing place. And you go to London today, and London's a pretty cool place. I mean, a lot of the old buildings have been cleaned up. There's some cool new skyscrapers. The whole, I think it's the southern side of the river, which was a dump. You wouldn't go there if your life depended on it. It was falling apart. It was in decay. It's been rejuvenated. It's been rebuilt. Modern places. It's just an amazing, amazing place in the world. One of my favorite cities in the world. I love going there. I go there often. Typically spend a few days, a couple of times a year in London. But it's a dynamic, exciting place. The city of London has become this major, major financial center in the world. That wasn't true before Thatcher. Certainly not to the extent that it's become since then. And Margaret Thatcher gets a lot of credit for that, for privatizing a lot of industry, for really decreasing the power of the unions, for revitalizing the UK economy. And I think everybody in politics, everybody with half a brain in the UK knows that. Now, a lot of the people in the street hate Thatcher for a variety of different reasons, and the intellectuals hate Thatcher, and they have inculcated that hatred into the people. And they attribute nothing of the success of the UK since the early 1980s to Margaret Thatcher. But that's an enormous injustice. And that has not been common among the political elites, because they realize that if they don't grow the economy, if they don't do well, they will lose the next election. And that has kind of played out in the UK differently than in the U.S. Much of the financial crisis was blamed on the left, not on the right, so that as an outcome of the financial crisis, the conservatives won. Now, these conservatives are pretty milquetoast conservatives. They're pretty lame when it comes to really free market policies. But they are certainly better than the left is. So it's an improvement over what is possible on the left. So the general consensus has been in politics in the UK is you cannot challenge the basic, generally pro-market, not pro-free market, but pro-market policies of Thatcher. You can improve on them. You can change them here and there. You can tinker. We can chip away a little bit. But you can't actually challenge them. And now comes Jeremy Corbyn, and I assume I'm pronouncing that right, but I have no idea. Maybe somebody can correct me. Now comes Jeremy Corbyn, and who basically says, I'm a socialist. I want to go back to 60s and 70s socialist policies of the labor movement in the UK. I want to renationalize many industries. And I want to institute explicit socialist policies in the UK. And by the way, I'm a huge admirer of Hugo Chavez. You know, huge admirer of Hugo Chavez. So why is Venezuela such a failure? Well, because it's all a conspiracy by the capitalists. It's all an American conspiracy to deny Venezuela the successful fruits of its socialism. And it's America that's creating internal turmoil, and it's Colombia, that greedy capitalist country on the Venezuela border that's creating problems, and those are the real issues. It's not socialism in Venezuela. Socialism in Venezuela works. It's liberated the poor. It's made life so much better. Can't blame that. Anyway. Jeremy Corbyn, an apologist for Venezuela socialism, is now the leader of the Labour Party. I mean, even many people within the Labour Party are horrified by this. Indeed, I think that if they had an election tomorrow, the Labour Party would be crushed even more than it was crushed, more than it was disappointed last election, because, you know, nobody, so few people in the UK actually pro-socialism, and enough of them remember you know, the catastrophe that was the 70s. So, you know, what's going on? You know, what is going on? In the United States of America, you've got Bernie Sanders being incredibly successful on the left. In many polls, he's ahead of Hillary Clinton in both Iowa and New Hampshire. Not on national polls, not when you take all states into account, but at least in those early states where the primary is going to be held, Bernie Sanders is in the lead. Bernie Sanders, who is a self-acknowledged socialist, certainly significantly to the left, or at least claims to be and is significantly to the left of mainstream Democrats. He is doing phenomenally well. We talked about this in the show before. More people attending his rallies than ever before. He's beating Hillary in some key states. What's up? Right? What is up? So socialism on the rise. Of course, elections today in Greece. Who knows who's going to win there? Well, I'm curious. We'll see. But obviously, the socialists have won there. Leftist parties all over the Europe doing quite seem to be doing quite well. We'll talk about whether that is really a trend. But at least in the United States and the UK, a real resurgence of the radical left, and maybe in the United States, greater interest in the radical left than ever in American history. Ever in American history with Bernie Sanders. What is going on? Well, if you have an opinion, call in 347-324-3075. I'd really like to hear from you guys today. 347-324-3075. Call in if you have an opinion about socialism, the resurrection of socialism, in spite of having killed in its consistent form under communism, killed over 200 million people, in spite of under its inconsistent form, just kind of social democracy, has bankrupted. Many countries around the world, most notably right now, it is bankrupting Venezuela. Already bankrupt Cuba, but is now bankrupting Venezuela. So why is it being resurrected? We're going to talk about the migration crisis in Europe. If you have opinions about that, you can call maybe a little bit later, but it's 347-324-3075. I have a feeling that immigration is always a big topic among my listeners, so I expect quite a bit of controversy when we get to that topic in a little while. So what's going on? Why didn't socialism die with the fall of the Berlin Wall? Suddenly, people thought that socialism was going to die. Many on the right, many libertarians, many conservatives, many kind of free market types thought that this was it. We'd won. It's over. It's over. Communism has failed. Market economies, to one degree or another, have succeeded. The debate was finished, according to them. You know, what is going on? If the debate was finished back then, you know, why has it come back? And I think this is where libertarians and conservatives don't get it. They really, really, really don't get it. Socialism will not die because it doesn't work. I don't think anybody ever believed it would work, really. Basic economics will teach you it doesn't work. Socialism won't die until its philosophical foundations are challenged. And nobody has ever done that other than Ayn Rand. Nobody has ever challenged socialism's philosophical foundations other than Ayn Rand. And as long as that is not challenged, socialism will keep coming back because socialism is moral. Socialism is just. Socialism is right, whether they call it social justice, whether it's under the guise of altruism or collectivism. if those ideas are never challenged, then people don't care how it does economically. And indeed, how it does economically is challenged continuously, right? We have a whole new generation of economists, from Paul Krugman to George Stiglitz, who claim the whole inequality cadre, Piketty, all of these guys, claim that what we've lost in our economy today is the glory of the socialism of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The world was so much better when socialism was in charge in places like the UK. And we don't get it. In those days, inequality was low. Economic growth supposedly was high. Life was great. And since the 1970s, things have gotten worse. The middle class has stagnated. The poor are getting poorer. And life sucks. So all we need is to go back to the glorious socialism of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Look at how Sweden was a heaven back then. And the UK was heaven back then. And even America was heaven back then. I guess these people didn't actually live through the 70s, but they pretend they did. So the whole inequality crusade, the whole inequality so-called economists, people like so-called economists like Paul Krugman and George Stiglitz, or as I like to call them, former economists. They once were economists. They become political hacks. They argue consistently that, in a sense, the period of nationalization, the period of so-called socialism in Europe and the United States, or more socialist policies, more equality-based policies, worked. And there's a whole cadre of young people who never lived, didn't live back then, weren't alive back then, weren't born back then. And then people who are delusional about that, who don't even know the facts. Places like Venezuela is just conspiracies or incompetence or so-called. So even though economically socialism was proved to be complete disaster in the 70s and then with the fall of the Berlin Wall in the 1980s, history is being rewritten before our eyes and nobody is challenging it. Nobody is challenging it. One of the reasons Don Watkins and I have written a new book, Equality is Unfair, that comes out in March of next year. And there's a PDF article about the topic that you can download from the Ayn Rand Institute website that is a really powerful attack on this whole inequality, the whole framing of the inequality debate, the whole history as presented by the inequality advocates. And we're going to be talking a lot about this whole issue of inequality on the radio show in the months to come as we get ready for the launch of the book. So one fact of the return of socialism is this rewriting of history. But much more important than that, much, much more important than the rewriting of history, is the fact that our culture still holds the philosophical ideas that make socialism possible, not just possible, but venerated, that make socialism an ideal. That makes socialism an ideal that the left, and to some extent the right, will always keep coming back to. And we will talk about what those philosophical ideas that make the ideal of socialism possible when we come back. And then at some point after that, we'll get back to the question of migration into Europe. If you want to discuss either one of those topics when we come back, 347-324-3075. And I think you have to press 1 or press star something to indicate that you want to ask a question. and we'll be right back to take
with adoring fans, rabid
right
critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten." Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at AynRand.org/NYC or call us toll-free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's AYNRAND.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
You're back. This is the Ron Brooks Show, and we're back after those advertisements. And let me just say, you know, the advertisement is there because many people listening to this show, and some of them are already in agreement, and many people are not. We have well over 3,000 people who listen to every one of these episodes, sometimes 5,000 to 6,000 people. Not all of them are already committed to these ideas. Not all of them even know that the Ayn Rand Institute exists. And even those of you who do know that the Ayn Rand Institute exists, have you contributed lately? All right, so why, oh, why is socialism still around? I think the ultimate answer is because Ayn Rand's ideas are not prevalent enough. Ayn Rand's ideas are not out there enough so that nobody other than Ayn Rand has challenged the underlying philosophical premises of socialism. And as a consequence, the philosophy of socialism was never attacked, was never challenged. And is, if anything, is more established in academia and among our intellectuals today than ever before. And the, you know, the outcome of that, the necessary outcome of that, is more statism and more socialism. Now, we've got a couple of callers here, so we're going to take this first call. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Dave from Portland, Oregon. Am I on the radio?
Hey, you are. Hey, Dave. How are you?
Oh, great, great. Yes, this is a fascinating topic for me, absolutely. You know, why is socialism on the rise, particularly with Bernie Sanders? And what I've been thinking about and writing about a little bit just to myself is I think a big source of it is emotionalism. If I can develop that a little bit, if we were to say, you know, an emotion is a reaction to a value judgment or a very disintegrated muddle, you know, masked as a value, then with that in mind, you know, for example, an emotion can be partially an indication of what is a value, but an emotion unchecked will always try to answer the when, you know, when should I get this value, whether it's muddled or not, and that unchecked, it will always say, oh, I want it right now, which, you know, can lead to a complete disregard for cause and effect, which is inherent in a rational process.
Sure. And I think you're right. I think most people, you know, are willing to try socialism over and over and over again because it has a certain emotional appeal because we've conditioned them. But I think there's something deeper going on, which has to do with why we let people become so emotionalist. And it has to do with the ethics and the real fundamental beliefs, philosophical beliefs that the culture holds that ultimately drive us towards being emotionalist, but are more philosophical. But you're absolutely right. I mean, people don't want to know what the facts are. If they cared about the facts, then there is no way that they would be, adopting these socialist policies because they've been such unbelievable failures, throughout history. They've never, ever worked. Socialism has never, ever worked. That's just a fact.
Yes, and, you know, it strikes me, and I don't know if you would agree with this, that often emotional thinking, the goal is not to actually come up with the truth, but it's to just justify your emotion. If you can just get that far, okay, I'm done thinking. Now I get back to the emotion.
Yeah, we call that rationalization. So I would call that rationalization. So I don't think there's such a thing as emotional thinking, right? There's thinking and there's emotions, and those are two separate things. And then what people do is they rationalize, they pretend to think, in a sense, they do pseudo-thinking, which is called rationalization, in order to justify their emotion. And you see that all the time. And I think, to a large extent, that's what these so-called economists do when they try to justify their socialism. They do it by rationalizing. They want certain things to be true, and they rationalize themselves. They in a sense, are detached from reality. They make up facts. They lie. They evade in order to assert their position. But it's not based on facts. It's not based on real thinking. Thanks, Dave. I really appreciate the call. And we're going to take another call here. And let's see, who's this on the line?
This is Tom from Northern Virginia, right outside of Washington.
Hey, Tom. Is this your first time calling in?
Yes, it is.
Okay, cool. What's up?
I listen all the time. Thank you very much for all the work you do.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I enjoy it.
I agree with what's been said already about the ethical dimensions of the problem. I do think, though, recently the recent resurgence has more to do with the fact that people think that this mess that we have today, they think it's capitalism. And I know you've talked about that, but I think that people think that what's going on is capitalism, and they're seeing all this these bailouts, and they want their fair share of the bailouts. I mean, it's their money being taxed away and given to bail people out. And I think they think that that's the system that they're living in, and they want their fair share of it.
I think you're right. And this is the great, default or great tragedy that our intellectuals are bought into the leftist narrative, and therefore they're not going to explain to the masses who are ignorant. They don't know. They're not going to explain to them what really caused the financial crisis. They're not going to explain to them, what causes bailouts and so on. They're not going to explain to them what's really going in the world. In quite the contrary, they feed off of the ignorance. They support the ignorance. And yes, I think so many people are convinced that capitalism caused the crisis, that capitalism, inherent in capitalism, is bailouts, which anybody who really studies or thinks about it for a minute knows that bailouts are the opposite of capitalism, right? Bailouts are government intervention, direct government intervention in the marketplace, and therefore the opposite of what capitalism really is. People are being taught that cronyism equals capitalism. It's exactly the opposite. Cronyism is a condition of statism, of socialism, of fascism, of any type of statism, of the mixed economy. And capitalism is the only antidote to cronyism. So they've been taught all this by the intellectuals, and it's the intellectuals who are the devils here, who keep the masses ignorant, who keep people ignorant, and therefore, what does one expect from people? I mean, you're right. All they want is some of their hard-earned money back. Their standard of living is not increasing at the rate that they expected from looking at their parents and looking at the past. They're struggling to make a living. Jobs out there are not plentiful. They're not good jobs. And the intellectuals, who are supposed to be the guides of the culture, and indeed are the guides of the culture, are blaming it all on capitalism. So I don't blame the common folk. I blame intellectuals through and through. Yeah, go ahead, Tom. Sorry.
Oh, no, I do just one more thing I wanted to add quickly. I think the objectivist movement needs to work harder to project exactly what a true capitalist society would look like. Now, I know in Atlas Shrugged there was the valley, Galt's Gulch and all that, but yeah. I think we need to do more in modern times in current times to project what that would actually look like specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think it's also very difficult to do partially because who knows what a truly capitalist society would look like, because that's the beauty of freedom. It's not centrally planned, so who knows what kind of directions it takes. I think if I would take your point more broadly, I think what the objectivist movement needs to be better at is presenting a positive vision for life. I think we need to be better at projecting the positive values, why this philosophy is so powerful in making an individual's life better and more successful. And I think if we can, and it's less about the politics, it's more about individual morality and individual success and individual flourishing. And if we can become the philosophy of individual flourishing and showing people how to live a good life, I think that's where we can be successful. So we need to be more projecting a positive vision for people's lives and explain to them how freedom will make their lives significantly better. Is that consistent with what you had in mind?
Absolutely. And I think that your contribution, since you have been director of the Ayn Rand Institute, I think you've moved things in that direction, and a lot of folks have. But I think it's important to do the best we can to talk about the possibility of capitalism.
I agree with you. And I've been executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute for a long time. Obviously, we still got a lot of work to do in terms of, I think, this positive vision. But thanks, Tom. I appreciate you reminding us of that. It's really important. It's so easy to be negative. It's much, much easier to be negative than it is to be positive. It requires a lot more effort. And where do you look at for the positive? There's very few things in the world to look at. And you have to be able to explain the philosophy at a certain level when you're trying to be positive. That's much more difficult when you're doing the negative. Okay, I still want to explain socialism, but we've got another call, which I love. This is great. Keep calling in. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Alex. Am I on the radio?
Yes, you are, Alex. Where are you calling in from?
I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm actually a freshman college student. I've been an objectivist for many, many years, and I listen to your show all the time.
You're a freshman college student, and you've been an objectivist for many, many years. Many, many
yes, sir.
Means something different to you than it does to me.
It does indeed, yeah. 14, it's only like 4 years, so many, many. That's a lot for me. But
so you started at 14. How did you discover objectivism at 14?
My dad and my grandfather actually showed me the movie version of Atlas Shrugged Part 1 when it came out, which inspired me to read the book. And once I read the book, I was absolutely hooked, and I watched all of Ayn Rand's interviews, and I read more of her nonfiction, and I became an objectivist very, very quickly after that.
Fantastic. And at 14. I read it at 16. I don't think it would have had quite the impact on me at 14, but that's terrific. You had a question, comment, Alex?
Yeah, I had a little story I wanted to tell you in relation to, you know, talking about socialism and how it's all emotion-driven. And actually, just the other night, I was watching the debate with the GOP, and at the same time, I was having a political debate with my friends on a Google Hangouts chat. And I ended up debating with one of them over taxation and government intervention, quote-unquote, helping the poor or whatever. Very much a socialist stance, and I was surprised because this kid's like really, really smart. He used to be kind of a libertarian, but since then he's kind of converted. But I approached it from a rational objectivist perspective and talked about rights and things like that. And, you know, when you get down to their core and attack them on it, they realize that, you know, they don't believe in this, because when I accused him of not supporting individual rights, he was taken aback by it. And eventually the debate ended, and a couple of days later, he came back to me and messaged me privately saying, you know, I was right. These beliefs that he had don't represent what he truly does believe. It's, you know, it was amazing to me that he, you know, came forward and did that, and he's a real smart kid. But, you know, I just wanted
That's
to
great.
Share, you know,
That's
you
great.
Approach rationally.
No, you're absolutely right. It's
with
the fundamental ideas, and if you can get them thinking about those ideas, the honest ones, particularly the young honest ones, can rethink them, and if you present a rational, logical alternative to their ideas, then you know that's how we're going to change the world. There is no shortcut; it has to
Absolutely.
Be by going to the fundamental ideas.
Absolutely.
Good. Well, good job, Alex. Great to have you. Great to have you on board as part of this objectivist movement.
Thank you very much.
No, absolutely, and you know, happy to. Really happy to hear that the young people are listening to the show. I have a feeling that so many of you guys listening to the show are old objectivists. It's great to hear some young voices, and also, you know, the idea that Atlas Shrugged could have a profound impact on somebody at 14 is fantastic and wonderful. And there's hope, right? If we can get these books into enough hands of young people, this is how we'll ultimately change the world. All right, why socialism? Well, we're gonna dig into the philosophical premise at the heart of socialism when we come back from this quick break, and after that we're gonna shift to another topic, another issue that's taking over Europe. Right, we've got socialism taking over parts of Europe, or at least growing in influence, and then we've got Muslim migration taking over the other parts. And is that ultimately going to lead to a socialist Europe? What kind of Europe are we going to have in the future if these trends continue? Is socialism really on the rise? Is that what we should fear? Or is it the Islamization of Europe, a Muslim Europe? Or is it something else? Well, you'll hear my take on that in just a few minutes. We'll be right back.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today at Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at AynRand.org/NYC or call us toll-free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's AynRand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
All right, we're back, and you're listening to the Ron Brooks Show, and we are talking about the resurgence of socialism, at least in the UK, and it seems as a new phenomena in the United States. And so let's talk a little bit about the causes for this, the philosophical causes for this. Socialism is based on specific philosophical premises. And I'd say in morality and in politics, those premises are altruism and collectivism. What is collectivism? Collectivism is the subjugation of the individual to the group. It could be any group. It could be the race. It could be class. Sound familiar? That's like kind of a Marxist form of collectivism. It could be the state. That's kind of a variety of different statism. But it doesn't matter. The main thing is, you as an individual don't count. What counts is the group. It could be the suffering. That would be a very Christian form of collectivism, right? And that would fit in nicely with the idea of altruism. Altruism means that your purpose in life, your moral purpose in life, is to sacrifice to others. It's to live for the sake of others. It's their well-being that is the standard, not your own. So Socialism is based on the idea of sacrifice, of individual not mattering, and the individual doesn't count. So what matters is the group, and the group in the socialist case is almost always the poor, the suffering, somebody who needs your help. And we'll get to how this is connected to the European migration crisis in a minute. You probably can see it already. It's almost kind of obvious. So the whole push of socialism is to, you know, leverage the altruism that is in the culture. And the altruism is prevalent in the culture. There's no question about the altruism in the culture, right? Nobody's challenged Christian altruism. Nobody, other than Ayn Rand. And again, Ayn Rand has only limited impact on the world as we know it. So that the standard by which people think, the standard that our kids are taught, is not the pursuit of their own happiness, making the most of their own life, an economic system that allows them to flourish. Oh, no. The standard is, and this is why, whenever I give a talk anywhere in the world, the first, or anywhere in the Western world, the first question I get is, what about the poor? Because what about the suffering? Because we've been conditioned that the standard of good is not you, is not what's good for you. It's not what's going to make your life better. The standard for good is the other who is suffering, the poor, as if there is such a category, the proletarian. What about them? What happens to them? They're suffering. Stuff is no good. Of course, what socialism says is we as a political system place those who are suffering as our standard. We will do everything for them. Even if the economy crashes and tumbles, even if the middle class and the rich lose their jobs and their wealth, even if there's no food, as long as we're trying to help the poor, everything's okay. Anything's legit. We're good. And this is why, in spite of everything going on in Venezuela, so many people around the world admire it. In spite of everything going on in Venezuela, the Pope still thinks that socialism is a good idea. Oh, we shouldn't exaggerate. We shouldn't go all the way to capitalism. Communism. But socialism, that's a good idea. Why? Because it sets up this group that, and even if everybody else has to suffer so that they can have what seems like maybe a little bit more material well-being, that's okay, because suffering, after all, is a virtue, particularly if those who suffer were the so-called privileged in the past. So Venezuela, in many respects, is all ideal for these people, in spite of the suffering. Well, no, not in spite of the suffering. Because of the suffering. Suffering is virtuous. That's what Christianity teaches us. That's what altruism teaches us. To suffer for the sake of somebody else is virtuous. And does this philosophy actually teach us that the most important thing is the well-being of the other person? That is, are these poor actually better off? No. We all know that the poor, the so-called poor, are best off under capitalism. But oh, we can't have that because of inequality, because the rich, the productive, are far better off. That's not acceptable because nobody's suffering. So the standard for altruism ultimately is not the benefit you provide the other person. The standard is your own suffering. The standard is your own demise. Now, people don't hold this, except for the intellectuals. They don't actually hold it intellectually, because you couldn't handle that. You would go crazy like James Taggart in Atlas Shrugged if you actually held, no, the real purpose of life is to suffer. I mean, very few people can do that. Mother Teresa was one, but that's an exception. Most people pretend that if I suffer, other people will benefit, that if we make the rich suffer, other people will benefit. That's the rationalization, the benefits of the people. And nobody can challenge that because altruism is the standard. The benefits of the people is the standard. All right, so unless altruism is challenged, And if you challenge altruism, that's the only way ultimately to challenge collectivism. Because what does it mean to say we subjugate the individual to the group? It means your life as an individual doesn't matter. And that's morality, right? That's ethics. That's altruism. My life doesn't matter. I'm supposed to serve you. That's what altruism teaches us. So to really challenge collectivism, one has to ultimately challenge altruism. And that nobody is willing to do. Nobody is willing to do. All right, we've got one more call. Let's see. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show.
Hello, Yaron.
Hi, who is this?
It's Martin from Europe.
Hi, Martin. How are you?
Today?
I'm good. How about
I'm
you?
I'm great. Thanks. I just wanted to know what are your recommendations for the European countries and the European Union as a whole?
With regard to the migration issue or broader than that?
Both.
Okay, well, let me take the broader quickly, and then I promise to talk about the migration issue, but you're going to have to give me a few more minutes before I get to it, okay?
All right.
I will definitely get to it. Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Martin.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, so quickly, for Europe as a whole, for America as a whole, for everybody, the fundamental is we have to challenge altruism. We have to fight it. We have to present an alternative. Rational egoism. Read Ayn Rand. Read The Virtue of Selfishness. Read The Ominous Parallels to really understand collectivism and what it does to a culture. Read The Ominous Parallels. Capitalism, Not Known Ideal. So these are the books to really arm yourself for the battle against altruism, which we have to engage in. That's where the action is. If we want to defeat socialism once and for all, we have to defeat altruism and collectivism. And to do that, you have to arm yourself to the teeth with Ayn Rand's ideas. Now, let me just hook into here to an aspect of what's going on in Europe. And I will get to the issue of migration in a minute. Look, the whole concept of the European Union has to fail when at the same time you are believing in collectivism. Collectivism doesn't work on a big scale. Collectivism is too local. If you're going to sacrifice for people, you want them to be people who are close to you. So collectivism, I believe, almost always long-term will lead to balkanization. So the European Union is, I think, a valuable project if it was based on a philosophy of individualism. Because under such a project, what difference does it matter if you're in Germany or in France? You want zero tariffs. You want people to be able to move. You want to be able to get jobs any way you can. The European Union, under a system of individualism, makes sense because it doesn't matter if you're German or French or Dutch or Swedish. European Union that's collectivistic, and yet nobody feels the collective bond of being European. Nobody feels the sense that there's anything that unites the French and the Germans and the Swedes and everybody else. And indeed, whatever used to unite them in a sense of a common Western ideology, if you will, they've lost. They have no conception of that. They don't know what it is. They can't define what it means to be European. They can't define a set of ideals that is common to them. Then they have nothing to keep them in a union. The union, qua union, loses all significance. So the European Union has to fail. It has to fall apart. It has to disintegrate. And you're seeing that, whether it's with the challenge of Greece, which is not over yet, or whether it's this migration problem, or whether it's the UK wanting to leave, or whether it's other countries maybe questioning whether they should have entered to begin with. There is no unifying idea there. And the European Union is susceptible to Islamist ideas and to other ideas because it isn't a set of ideas. It's a vague sense of collectivism and altruism. And this plays heavily into the migration crisis, which we'll get to in a second. But we're going to take a quick call from the Iran, and then we're going to get back into the this question of European migration. Hi, Iran. You're on the Iran Book Show.
What's up? I have an answer to you. I'm a bit sick, but I have a friend who's taking care of me, so I'm lucky. I wanted to talk about why socialism is a thing from the angle of identifying cause and separating it from pretext. What pretext is, what I say when I do something. For example, Hitler's pretext was, I'm gonna take the Sudetenland because they're resisting Germans. His real cause was to simply attack his simple policy. And then now the question is, what would a person need in order to figure out what is the cause from socialism and what must be its effect?
Well, I mean, I think the cause of socialism is what I said. I think it's a bad philosophy. And
it's just like
at the end, I don't think Hitler attacked just because he individually was a power luster. I mean, that's part of the psychological motivation.
Yes.
But the reason he could pull it off was because he and the people around him and the German people had adopted a really, really bad philosophy. But
I think Hitler did believe it.
What's that?
I think Hitler did believe it. Don't think Mussolini or, Paolo Chavez believed
it. I disagree with you. I think they do believe it. And indeed, everybody believes it. Who is not an outlier?
They have to believe in something.
Well, everybody has to believe in something. And there's no alternative. You know, everybody in the culture today believes in some form of altruism. Whether they acknowledge it or not, it's in their blood because it's in our it's in their mind, not their blood, because it's in our educational system everywhere. And then
the pretext is
helping the poor. The pretext, because altruism doesn't care about the poor.
Not care about anyone.
Yes, exactly.
Because it completely cuts off value from valuer.
Exactly.
If I want to do something, there's no reason. If I do something, there's no reason to prove. One second.
You're breaking up.
Anyone? Can you hear?
Yeah, but you're breaking up. So I'm gonna end it here. But you're absolutely right. I mean, what altruism does is it separates values from valuer, and therefore makes values a meaningless concept. So, at the end of the day, all altruism cares about philosophically is the suffering, the destruction, right? But they can't hold that. So they need a pretext. And the pretext is, the pretext says it's going to solve the world's problems. It's going to help the poor. The pretext is capitalism failed. The pretext is what alternative is there? Look at what happens with cronyism. So all of that is pretext. And then, of course, the rulers, some of them believe in altruism. Some of them don't believe in anything. Some of them are just power lusters. And it's very difficult to differentiate between who is a real power luster and who is a more ideological believer in these ideas. It's very difficult, but that's not important, I don't think, because what we face if we're fighting for capitalism, for freedom, for individualism, what we need to challenge is the philosophy. Well, just pointing out that somebody's a power luster, it doesn't work. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. Nobody's ever cared. Because as long as the power luster is using the philosophy, people buy into it. People accept what you would call the excuse or whatever, right? What we need to do is challenge the whole way of thinking. What we need to do is challenge altruism and collectivism. We have to present an alternative. We have to reject Kant and reject Comte and reject Christianity. You will not, capitalism, unless you reject altruism. You cannot reject altruism until you reject its philosophical core, which is in the religious side in Christianity and in the secular side in Kant and his heirs. All right, when we get back, we'll talk about how all this plays into the current migration crisis in Europe and what I would do if I were running one of these European countries.
Selfishness, a virtue? It is according to the moral principles of objectivism. Conventional morality tells you to sacrifice your values to satisfy the needs of others. Ayn Rand opposes that view and offers a new concept of egoism, an ethics of rational selfishness that rejects sacrifice in all its forms. In The Virtue of Selfishness, Ayn Rand defies conventional thought, setting out a philosophy that holds man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life. Explore Rand's new concept of egoism and order The Virtue of Selfishness at Amazon.com today.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, and free minds. You can join our battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support.
You're listening to the Iran Book Show. Welcome back. We're talking about socialism, migration crisis, and how to fight altruism. And let me make a quick point here, and we're going to have to spend a lot more time in a future show on this. But to fight altruism, to fight collectivism, one first has to fight for reason. One first has to fight for the mind. A previous caller talked about the emotionalism of the culture. Yes. The culture we live in today is an irrational culture because we've been taught not to think. We've been taught to emote. So the first thing we have to do is teach people to think, to use their minds, to accept reality. Focus that thinking on making their own lives the best lives that they can be, which is the purpose of a morality of egoism. So we will get to that. We will talk more about that in future shows. And hopefully what you're getting in this show is an example of that, a proper thinking of how to look at the facts, of how to evaluate them, of how to examine them. Okay, let's look at this migration crisis, and we don't have a lot of time. So this is going to be a quick, and I promise we'll dedicate a future show to discussing this in greater depth. But what is going on here? And I want to leverage off of the show we had last week with Ilan Juno, who guest hosted the show for me and talked about the lessons from 9/11 and kind of the failure of American foreign policy. And I'd broaden that from American foreign policy to Western foreign policy, to European and American foreign policy, right? So we have lost, the West has lost, is losing its war against the Islamic totalitarians, against the jihadis. We're losing. And that is manifest in the rise of ISIS, in the rise of Iran, in the increased power of Iran, in the increased influence of Saudi Arabia. Generally, the increased influence of the Islamists all over the Middle East. And the continuing radicalization of those Islamists in Europe and the United States. That is, people who used to be what some people call moderate Muslims are being radicalized in large numbers all over the Middle East, Asia, Europe, and the U.S. And that fundamentally, and I'm not going to get into how, but that is fundamentally caused by a weak, pathetic, unprincipled response to 9/11 and to all the aggression against the United States and the West pre-9/11 and since 9/11. We are unprincipled, weak, and pathetic in the way we're dealing with the Middle East. And as a consequence, the jihadis are only gaining power and gaining self-esteem and gaining influence. And this has direct relationship to the migration crisis because first of all, the whole disaster that is Iraq and Syria, the disaster that is in Afghanistan, the disaster that is Libya, wouldn't even exist if not for our weakness. If we had crushed the enemy, taught them a lesson, and made jihadism as popular as Japanese imperialism 50 years ago, or Nazism. Why is Nazism is unacceptable, but jihadism, that's okay. We're tolerating that all over the world, even as they try to kill us. So that is the core, I think, that our foreign policy has made this crisis possible by not dealing with a problem head on. Now, add to that the fact that Europe is dominated by altruism, by a sense of a Kantian duty to the suffering in the world. Europe is a welfare state that embraces giving welfare to all who come, to all who come. And what you get is a situation where you've got, one, a lot of people displaced in the Middle East because of, to a large extent, because of our failed foreign policy. You've got some of them radicalized so that they have an incentive to come into Europe and create havoc in Europe. And you've got Europeans who have no basis by which to prevent them from coming in because their whole basis for existence is altruism, and therefore they've created not just any kind of barrier to letting them in, but indeed a welcome mat, which is financial welcome mat. If you go to Europe today and you declare yourself an asylum seeker, and you're from certain countries, you're guaranteed to get it, in particular countries like Germany. And then they give you a stipend. I think in some countries, I had this here a few minutes ago, but in some countries, it's like 800 euro a month, or just under 800 euros a month. You get free housing. In some places, the housing's not that great. It's like camps that, like in Spain, it's so bad that the migrants actually go sleep in the streets. But in Germany, and particularly in Sweden, they treat you really, really nicely. That's why, by the way, most of these migrants are heading to Sweden and to Germany, because that's where they're treated best in terms of handed out goodies. They're allowed to work immediately, which, you know, I'm not against migrants working. I'm for that. But in those countries and other countries, they're not allowed to work, but yet they get money. I mean, the whole system is a welfare system for the world's poor. The whole system is basically putting out a welcome mat to anybody who doesn't have any money and will give you a check. I mean, and then, if you add to that, that they're not expected to assimilate. They're not expected to become Europeans because that would be too assertive for the Europeans to try to get the immigrants to become Europeans. They are treated with kid gloves. When they commit crimes, you can't say that, I don't know, Muslims in Sweden commit most of the rapes, because that is deemed insensitive. And you can go to jail in Sweden for saying something like that, even if statistically it's true. If somebody did go to jail, he was fined, he didn't go to jail, but he was fined. And the judge said, even though what you're saying is true, it's insensitive. And therefore, we're going to fine you. So Europe is basically committing massive suicide. Massive suicide. It's allowing the enemy in. The enemy is jihadis. They can't separate who is a jihadi, who's not, because they don't have the tools to do that. So you have to basically say, at least until you have the tools to separate it out, no Muslims into the country. But they're doing the opposite. All Muslims in. Whoever wants, come on in. But you're at war with many of these people. Not with all of them, but with many of them. Try to differentiate? No, no, no. We can't even try to differentiate. So it's basically Europe is committing suicide. It's driven by Christian altruism, and you can see the Christianity. I mean, they keep saying, the Hungarians say, oh, we're Christians, we can't allow these Muslims in. And the Germans say, we're Christians, we have to allow the immigrants in, right? Because where's Christian charity? Where's Christian altruism? You can't assert yourself. They're suffering. You have to allow it in. And if it means that we are sacrificed as a consequence, so what? That's our duty. And that's why the Germans, right, they infused with Kantian duty. We have to do this. Damn the consequences. And then they have elevated multiculturalism, political correctness. They can't assert any kind of sense of superiority for their culture. They can't assert that they are any good and that anybody should assimilate and become like them. So Europe is on the verge of suicide. Now, I'm going to articulate a certain vision for how that suicide is going to take place, because I don't think it's what many people think. Most people think that the suicide is going to come about by the Islamists basically taking over, and by the Muslims becoming the, you know, dominant authoritarian force within Europe. And some of you may have heard me say this before, but I don't think that's going to happen. I really do not. In some ways, I think the outcome is a lot scarier than even that. Because, I don't consider Islam a threat. Because if we had any sense of self-esteem, if we have any sense of self-assertion, we could defeat them in a week. There's nothing there. There's no, who are we fighting? They have nothing. Nothing. They have to steal their weapons or use oil in order to buy them. They produce nothing. They create nothing. They don't build their own weapons. They're nothing. If the West truly was committed to a war with the jihadis, we could win it and win it quickly and win it easily. So what scares me is not Islam. What scares me is the response of Europe to Islam. Because I think where we're heading in Europe is towards a new form of fascism. And this is where, in some sense, the rise of socialism is faking us out. I don't think the left is the party that's gaining in Europe. It's the populist right. It's the populist, xenophobic, racist right that's gaining in Europe. And they're gaining primarily because of their rejection of open immigration for Muslims, very reasonable position to have, right? But they bring with it an authoritarian bent. And they bring with it populist economics. They bring with it a form of collectivism and racism that Europe really hasn't seen since World War II. And to me, that is the real danger for Europe. Are the Germans really going to roll over and let the Muslims just take over their country? Really? This is Germany we're talking about? At some point, the collectivist, nationalist ideas of Germany will resurrect, will resurface. And we're in trouble when they do. It will be very scary when it does. Because I would not be surprised if in 30, 40 years there are concentration camps in Europe, and this time there are Muslims in those concentration camps. They'll throw in the Jews for good measure, because, you know, why waste a concentration camp? But the point is, when European culture gets to the point of having concentration camps, we're in deep, deep, deep trouble in the West. And who's going to fight them? Because where's the United States going to be in 30, 40 years? Is it going to be in any kind of position to resist fascism? That kind of fascism. What I fear is the radicalization of Europe towards collectivism, altruism, Kantianism, and ultimately nationalism. The European project, the European Union, is undoable because Europe is still collectivist. It is only doable under German occupation or a separate little countries, Balkanization. And Balkanization leads to war. And war is usually won by the strongest, who then unifies everybody under a flag. So what the migration crisis is going to lead to is the breakup, ultimately, of the European Union, which that will lead to Balkanization and greater strife. More and more of this immigration will lead to more and more resentment among Europeans, which will lead, ultimately, I think, to some form of European fascism and nationalism. So I am very pessimistic in Europe, and the UK should get out of the European Union as quick as it can. You know, and as long as the European Union exists right now, by charter, by the way, all members are required to ensure, quote, a dignified standard of living for asylum seekers that includes housing, food, clothing, a daily allowance, and access to public health care, education, and the job market while their claim is being processed. In some countries, that can take up to 4 years. So by charter, they have to provide for these people. They have to sacrifice for them. They have to provide a welfare subsistence for them. And that's just horrific. I mean, I'm a pro-immigration guy, but not under terms where you're required to sacrifice for the immigrants, not under terms where the immigrants are coming in who are dedicated, a certain percentage of them, are dedicated to your own destruction because they're jihadis and you can't tell the difference between them. So Europe's heading towards a disaster, and the fact is it doesn't matter what Europe does right now. It's heading towards a disaster. Let's say Europe builds a wall. Under what theory is it going to build a wall? What is going to hold that wall together? And what about the resentment in Germany of immigrants from Eastern Europe? Are we going to build a wall against them as well? Europe is doomed whether it accepts these immigrants or not. The acceptance in mass of these immigrants is just going to speed things up. That's all. But what Europe needs is a philosophical revolution. What Europe needs, what America needs, what we all need is to rediscover our Enlightenment roots. What we need is to rediscover the Enlightenment ideas of reason and individualism. And until we do, until we elevate reason and individualism. None of this matters, right? None of this matters, although some things make things work faster and other things make them slower. And what you're seeing today before your eyes on the television screen is the beginning, well, not the beginning, kind of the middle of the end of Europe as we know it, as a place that respects freedom and individuals. All right, we'll be right back and we'll try to turn positive after the break.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at aynrand.org/NYC or call us toll free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's aynrand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem, these works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
All right, we're back, and we're going to try to be a little bit more positive. We will do future shows on immigration and get into immigration, the whole issue of immigration in greater depth. There's a lot to be said about immigration. I think so many people, even so many objectivists, I don't think approach the issue correctly. I just gave you a tidbit there, but there's a lot to say about the issue, and it's complicated. And let me just say this principle. We'll deal with the principles next time. But at the end of the day, I'm pro-immigration. And you don't correct one violation of rights by violating more rights. But you know, you have to look at the context, and you have to look at the context of war, and you have to look at the context of what is going on in the world. And we all know kind of what the ideal would be, but how to deal with the concretes of today, not simple. We'll talk about it. Look, at the end of the day, objectivism is about living your own life. Objectivism is about pursuing happiness. It's about living the best life that you can be. And I believe that a lot of objectivists, unfortunately, focus too much of their lives on the political situation, focus too much of their lives on what's going on, around them with other people and politics. And they use it as an excuse not to be successful in life, which I think is terrible, but also as an excuse not to live life to the fullest. So I'm here to tell you, stop it. In spite of all the problems in the world, there are plenty of opportunities to be successful and happy out there. But you got to take your life seriously, and you got to take reason seriously. You got to think. You got to figure it out. And you got to challenge yourself. You got to push yourself. You got to think and experience outside of the envelope. Ayn Rand did not tell us to just be conventional. She told us the opposite. The conventional culture, the conventional society was motivated and focused and inspired by bad ideas. So the culture is bad. So you must seek a better culture. You must seek your own happiness. So whether it's professionally, you got to go out there and find ways to be successful. We still can be successful, at least in the U.S. and I think in some other countries, not everywhere in the world. Go out there and try to be successful in your career. And if your first career doesn't succeed, very few of us know exactly what we want, and we can only do one thing because that's our passion, like the Howard Roark of the world. Most of us can do multiple things and still be happy. One thing doesn't work, find something else. You should focus your life on being happy and being successful, not on how awful the world is. So I know my radio show doesn't help when I go all negative on you like I did today, but you got to take it in the right perspective. Hopefully, it gives you some intellectual ammunition. It gives you some inspiration that people are fighting the battle for you, with you. That's my job. But even though this is my job, I look for opportunities all the time to do fun things, to do things that I really enjoy above and beyond my career, which is primarily engaged in fighting the culture. You know, I've talked a lot about good movies. Movies are good. And I've talked a little bit about this, but you got to go out and find, I think one of the things least appreciated by objectivists is aesthetics. Great art. Romantic art, inspiring art, art that will really move you, evoke emotions, really get deep. So I really encourage you to go out there and experience art, whether it's film. Film is the easiest in a sense. There's good movies. It's easy. It's easy to keep attention to it. But go read a good novel. Go to a museum, an old museum of 19th century and pre. Go try to appreciate good works of art. Take an art appreciation course, a good one. Granted, they're not all good, but a good one that focuses on old art, not so-called new art. Listen to music. But again, don't just accept what the culture serves up to you as music. I've said this before, but go look at classical music. Go listen to some classical music. And again, I'll recommend some stuff. I'm a huge fan. I'll say this here. I'm a huge fan of Beethoven. Love Beethoven. Love almost all everything he did. Ayn Rand was not. For good reason. There's a certain malevolence in Beethoven. There's no question about that. But there's a sense of passion, of drive, of struggle, of success, of victory, of fight. Beethoven's a fighter. I'm a fighter. I relate to that. I love Beethoven. I love his chamber music. I love his symphonies. Go listen. Try it out. And try poetry. Now, Lenin Peikoff has a wonderful lecture. You can get it on the Ayn Rand bookstore on his favorite poetry. It's fantastic. It's so much fun, particularly listening to other people recite poetry. Go watch a good play. Go watch Shakespeare. Yeah, philosophically it's corrupt, but the beauty of the way he structures the drama, of the language, of the situations, of the plot, it's so enjoyable. I love Shakespeare. Love watching Shakespeare on stage. So there's a lot of culture out there. There's a lot to inspire you. There's a lot to make you spiritually healthy. And if you do it with the right approach, you can win. You can benefit. Don't give up on your life just because the world sucks. That's my message today. This is the Iran Book Show. Tune in next week, 11:30 Pacific time. Blog Talk Radio right here. And next week, we're going to get back to the Chicago station on AM560. Talk to you then. Have a great week. And enjoy.